Oh, Okay, und da sind wir wieder mit Talking Anthropology. Der erste Teil dieser Show heute wird auf Deutsch sein, weil wir zwei deutschsprachige Gäste haben, und danach werden wir auf Englisch weitermachen. Und ich will anfangen mit dem Andi, ein Kollege aus meinem Hackerspace aus Österreich, aus Wien, das MetaLab, und auch ein Village-Kollege aus dem Leihwandwil. Gleich um die Ecke von unserem Radiozelt befindet sich nämlich dieses Village von den Wiener Leuten. Aber ich glaube, wir haben ja auch noch ein paar andere Leute dabei, die nicht vom MetaLab sind, oder?
Ja, wir haben uns da ganz gut eingerichtet. Nicht nur die Leute vom MetaLab, auch ein paar andere Österreicher von Graz bis Vorarlberg und dann noch mit den deutschen Freunden von der Chaoswelle. Das sind die Funkamateure des CCCs. Wir haben uns da auf einen gemeinsamen Platz gelegt, gesetzt, gezeltet und machen da gemeinsame Projekte.
Okay, und eins dieser Projekte ist das, worüber wir jetzt nochmal genauer reden werden, nämlich das Moonbounce-Projekt. Worum geht's dabei?
Ja, Moonbounce oder Erde, Mond, Erde, das ist ein ganz tolles Ding, dass wir als Funkamateure betreiben. Und zwar nimmt man da einfach eine Funkantenne, ein Funkgerät, einen großen Verstärker und sendet Radiosignale zum Mond, die dann vom Mond wieder reflektiert werden und wieder zurückkommen. Und das können dann andere Stationen auf der Erde oder auch man selbst wieder auffangen. Damit kann man über den Mond über eine Entfernung von 750.000 Kilometern Funkverbindungen herstellen.
Wow, und das Signal, wie lange braucht das, um diesen Weg zurückzulegen?
Naja, 750.000 Kilometer, ja, kann man etwa sagen, 2,5 Sekunden, also eine gute Sekunde hin, eine gute Sekunde zurück, und dann, ja, dann ist es schon wieder da.
Okay, und jetzt die böse Frage, funktioniert es schon?
Ja, ich habe gerade, glaube ich, den letzten Stecker gelötet, bevor ich hier zum Interview bin. Und ja, werden wir sehen in einer Stunde. Der Mond ist jetzt vor einigen Minuten aufgegangen. Jetzt warten wir noch, bis ein paar Grad mehr über dem Horizont ist, und bis dahin sollte es tun.
Okay, und was werdet ihr senden?
Ja, wir werden versuchen, Kontakt mit anderen Stationen auf der Erde aufzunehmen, und zwar mit einem digitalen Datenübertragungsverfahren, das dafür ausgelegt ist, dass man sehr schwache Signale noch entziffern kann und dadurch noch brauchbare Daten rüberzubekommen. Schnell ist es nicht, also wir haben vielleicht 5 Baus pro Sekunde oder 5 BPS, aber man kann immerhin etwas darüber senden und auch wieder empfangen.
Und wieso habt ihr euch für dieses Projekt entschieden?
Ja, weil es geht und weil wir es können, oder eigentlich, weil wir wollen, weil wir wissen wollen, ob wir es können. Also das wird gemacht und es gibt's, und wir sind eine relativ frische Amateurfunktruppe im MetaLab, und wir wollten einfach mal das aufwendigste oder das am meisten aufwendige Verfahren mal ausprobieren. Jetzt, wo wir die Chance haben, so viele Leute zusammenbekommen, auch viele interessierte, technikbegeisterte Zuschauer, und das einfach einmal ausprobieren. Und ob es funktioniert, wird sich zeigen, aber wir sind bester Dinge.
Und vielleicht, damit man mal eine Relation bekommt davon, wie aufwendig das ist. Ihr habt ja das gesamte Equipment, was ihr dafür braucht, aus Wien hierher gebracht. Ihr habt wahrscheinlich ziemlich viel Zeit investiert, und auch, du bist ja nicht alleine dabei, du hast ein Team. Kannst du uns da mal ein paar Zahlen geben, dass man Relation bekommt, wie aufwendig das ist?
Ja, aufwendig, der Transport, ja, das ist ganz richtig. Das ist natürlich das Aufwendigste gewesen, weil wir haben auch die Masten mitbekommen. Also eine Antenne kannst du nicht auf den Boden legen, da braucht man doch einen Masten, wo man sie raufgeben kann. Der muss sich drehen, der muss sich nach oben und unten bewegen, weil der Mond steht ja nicht fix am Himmel, der bewegt sich über den Himmel. Und das, ja, dann brauchst du Funkgeräte, du brauchst Verstärker, du brauchst Stromversorgung, und dann müssen wir natürlich auch noch was zu essen kaufen. Also das müssen wir auch, weil wir brauchen auch Futter, nicht nur Strom fürs Funkgerät.
Wunderbar. Ja, ich glaube, dann werde ich dich jetzt wieder entlassen, damit du rechtzeitig wieder zurückkommst und das Ganze heute live geht. Wann können die Leute zu euch vorbeischauen, um diesen Moment zu erleben?
Na, ich denke, jetzt, nachdem der letzte Stecker gelötet ist, in etwa einer Stunde wird es doch losgehen. Also der Mond ist, wie gesagt, gerade aufgegangen, einige Grad über den Horizont. Sehen sollte man schon, weil wir können natürlich nicht durch die Bäume funken. Mhm. Noch ein paar Grad und dann geht's. Also in einer Stunde wird es schon ganz gut gehen.
Okay, 9 am Abend ist das dann. Okay, gut, dann haben die Leute was vor in dieser Zeit, und ich danke dir und ja, viel Erfolg. Ja, gehen wir weiter in der Show. Wir haben jetzt noch was, wahrscheinlich das eine Interview, an das sonst niemand gedacht hat. Das war zumindest meine Idee dabei, und zwar den Dr. Koppe, der Chef des Luftfahrtmuseums Finowfurt. Herzlich willkommen.
Ja, freue mich auch.
Können Sie das Mikrofon ein bisschen höher geben? So. Ja, jetzt müsste man Sie hören. Wunderbar. Ja, Sie sind der Chef oder der Direktor von diesem Museum hier. Und können Sie uns vielleicht mal generell etwas erzählen über dieses Museum, wo auf dem Grund, wo sich dieses Camp hier befindet? Wie lange gibt es dieses Museum schon? Es ist ein Luftfahrtmuseum. Welche Gerätschaften und Ausstellungen haben Sie hier?
Das ist ja nicht nur eine Frage, schwer zu beantworten. Also ihr seid hier, wir sind Gastgeber dieses Camps. Das Museum selbst gibt es im nächsten Jahr 20 Jahre. Wir haben also schon einiges hinter uns. Und es befindet sich auf einem ehemaligen Militärflugplatz, der vor 1945 als deutscher Militärflugplatz gegründet wurde und nach 1945 von den sowjetischen Besatzungstruppen bis 1993 benutzt wurde. Und ja, danach haben wir in den Besitz genommen und diese Fläche, diese Teilfläche von diesem Flugplatz haben wir erworben als Verein. Und bauen hier gehen hier unserem Hobby nach. Das ist eine reine Hobbyinitiative. Mhm. Das ist keine Profitruppe, sondern das alles, was ihr hier seht, alles, was an Infrastruktur, was an Ausstellung noch zu sehen ist, ich betone das noch, ist durch ehrenamtliche Arbeit geschehen. Und das noch bezieht sich darauf, dass wir für die Vorbereitung des Camps ja fast zwei Drittel der gesamten Ausstellungsräume beräumen mussten. Und, insofern ist nur noch ein kleiner Teil momentan zu sehen.
Vielleicht können Sie uns mal erklären, wieso Sie diese Gastfreundschaft anbieten für den Chaos Computer Club. Also wie ist das Verhältnis zu dieser Veranstaltung von Ihrer Seite?
Wir haben Sie ja schon vor 4 Jahren kennengelernt. Es gab viele skeptische Stimmen, auch in unseren eigenen Reihen, außerhalb und noch mehr. Man meinte, das würde hier nicht herpassen und so weiter. Aber die Leute meines Vorstandes waren der Meinung, das machen wir, das wagen wir. Einfach deshalb, weil wir wollen nicht nur einfache Veranstaltungen, wir machen Veranstaltungen hier, sehr viele Veranstaltungen, refinanzieren damit das Museum. Und am Anfang war auch dieses Camp eine Veranstaltung, die mithelfen sollte, das Museum zu refinanzieren. Aber inzwischen, vor allen Dingen bei 4 Jahren und in den zwischenzeitlichen Kontakten, hier waren ja immer auch Teilbereiche, wie zum Beispiel die Quadrocopter und so weiter, waren ja hier auch in der Zwischenzeit, haben wir gemerkt, dass uns der Kontakt mit jungen Leuten, mit technisch interessierten Leuten, mit klugen und kritischen jungen Leuten sehr gut bekommt. Das merken unsere Leute sowohl was die Leitung, sowohl in der Leitung, als vor allen Dingen auch die einfachen Leute, die bei uns arbeiten. Und sie haben diese Leute, ohne Übertreibung zu sagen, richtig lieb gewonnen. Das ist, kommt vom Herzen und das spüren wahrscheinlich auch unsere Gäste. Mhm. Und das setzt sich fort, das beginnt bei unserem Service, den wir haben. Wir bieten ja da oben ein bisschen Essen an. Und ich habe noch nie erlebt, dass diese Frauen, die ja nun früher nie Englisch gesprochen haben, inzwischen auch ein Wörterbuch bei der Hand haben und lernen, das ein oder andere Wort Englisch zu sprechen, damit sie ihren Gästen ordentlichen Service bieten können. Das geht weiter, dass Leute hier schon seit Tagen versuchen, den Platz mit sauber zu halten, die Toiletten zu reinigen, alles ganz wichtige Infrastrukturfragen, die, wenn sie nicht gelöst werden, eine schlechte Stimmung bringen. Und die Leute fragen nicht nach ihren Stunden, sie fragen nicht nach Geld, sondern sie machen es. Mhm. Und
Es gibt ja diese Gemeinsamkeit, Sie haben vorher gesagt, dass dieses Museum von Freiwilligen betrieben wird und auch diese ganze Veranstaltung wird ja von Freiwilligen organisiert. Niemand bekommt Geld dafür, dass er hier mithilft, dass er Security spielt oder am Eintritt arbeitet, sondern es ist in dieser Größenordnung eine von sehr wenigen Veranstaltungen, die sich nur auf Freiwilligen stützt. Gibt es da eigentlich neben diesem Event auch noch andere Kooperationen?
Ja, genau, das ist der Punkt, den ich ansprechen wollte. Da haben wir vor 4 Jahren schon sehr stark partizipieren können und das wird, ich glaube, diesmal bei diesem Fest noch größer. Ich habe schon so viele Kontakte hier geknüpft mit den jungen Leuten, und ich bemühe mich zu verstehen, was man da so gezeigt bekommt und ich versuche natürlich sofort die Verbindung herzustellen zu Anwendungsmöglichkeiten hier bei uns. Und da gibt's schon die tollsten Sachen. Was mir spontan einfällt, gerade auf dem Weg eben, sind hier Leute, die so einfache Raketen bauen und sie starten. Das ist ideal für die Betreuung unserer Kinder, die wir Kindergruppen. Nicht? Wir können das Rückstoßprinzip mithilfe dieser Raketen wunderbar vorstellen. Also wir werden mit denen zusammenarbeiten. Eine andere Gruppe hat uns angeboten, ein neues Kommunikationssystem für die Infotafeln zu entwickeln für uns, rechnergestützt natürlich, mit den entsprechenden Andockstationen und so weiter. Mit denen werden wir zusammenarbeiten, gemeinsam vielleicht mit der Hochschule in Wildau. Wir haben uns überlegt, wie wir das mit den mit den Schlüsseln machen, diese Schlüsselöffner, ich weiß nicht, ob Sie die gesehen haben.
Die
hier, diese,
ja.
Da mag man denken, was hat das mit dem Museum zu tun? Aber wir, bei diesen großen Toren, die wir hier haben und den vielen, vielen Türen, haben wir ständig das Problem, dass einer nicht weiß, wo der Schlüssel ist. Und wir werden solche Möglichkeiten sicher brauchen, um uns lange Suchereien hier zu ersparen. Solche banalen und einfachen Dinge. Aber wir wollen natürlich auch versuchen, mit den die etwas anspruchsvolleren Themen, die hier bearbeitet werden, nicht an den 3D-Drucker denke, das ist eine fantastische Möglichkeit für den Modellbau, den wir hier haben, nicht? Und solche Anwendungsfälle, da bin ich jetzt auf der Tour schon seit Tagen. Die Zeit, die ich jetzt habe, am Anfang war das natürlich nicht schlecht möglich. Da musste ich mich um die einfachen organisatorischen Dinge kümmern. Momentan läuft das ja fantastisch, es gibt kaum Probleme. Und ich habe Zeit, mich um solche Sachen zu kümmern.
Ja, was ich oft gehört habe und wo ich auch selber nochmal einen Dank aussprechen will, ist die Bereitwilligkeit, mit der sich hier gewisse Dinge zur Verfügung stellen, wie zum Beispiel die Flugzeuge, die auf dem Gelände stehen, werden ja nochmal extra ausgeleuchtet, beziehungsweise es gibt Gorilla-Knitting, das heißt, es wurde über einen Kampfjet wurde gestickt über die Spitze und auch, ich glaube, über eine Rakete habe ich es gesehen. Also sozusagen, es wird eine Form von Street Art, von Graffiti mit Häkelarbeit gemacht. Oder mit Stricken. Und ich glaube, es gibt ja noch einen anderen Künstler, der da drüben bei Milliways ein Projekt hat. Vielleicht können Sie uns darüber noch was erzählen.
Ja, das ist aber jetzt reiner Zufall, dass der hier gerade auftaucht. Er behauptet zumindest, ich glaube es nicht ganz. Das ist ein Künstler, der inzwischen auch internationalen Ruf hat. Das ist der Heiko Saxo, der, mit dem wir schon viele Jahre hier lockeren Kontakt halten, der sonst ein Globetrotter ist, der in Europa in bestimmten Kreisen sehr gut bekannt ist. Und wir haben einen Deal mit ihm gemacht. Wir haben ihm ein Flugzeug überlassen, wo wir ohnehin nicht die Kraft haben, entsprechend zu sanieren. Und er vergoldet es jetzt. Und da bringt er seine ganze Kraft ein. Und wir haben viele andere Kunstobjekte, die er gestaltet hat. Die werden wir heute Abend übernehmen. Um 21 Uhr ist die offizielle Übergabe dieser Kunstobjekte. Und wir werden sie ordentlich betreuen, werden sie integrieren in unsere Sammlung. Und ich denke, ein bisschen Kunst steht uns auch gut zu Gesicht. Es ist vieles, da es ja eine militärische Anlage ist, ist sehr vieles rational und sehr militärisch auch ausgerichtet. Und da wird etwas Kunst die Dinge ganz schön auflockern.
Mhm. Vielleicht können wir noch mal einen Schritt zurückgehen in der Historie. Können Sie sich noch erinnern, wie sich diese Zusammenarbeit mit dem CCC angebahnt hat? Wer ist da zu wem gekommen?
Ich bin nicht ganz sicher, aber ich vermute, einer der vielen Veranstaltungen, die wir ohnehin gemacht haben, ich glaube, es war das Roadrunner, das ist so eine Veranstaltung, die von Berliner Kollegen hier organisiert wird, das ist so die Szene, Rock'n'Roll-Szene der 50er Jahre, die haben wir hier, jetzt fliegt gerade die AN2 hier über uns, tolles Erlebnis, der größte Doppeldecker der Welt. Zurück zu Roadrunner.
Die Hörer haben es schon oft gehört.
Ja, für mich ist das immer wieder, als Flugzeugfanatiker ist es immer wieder ein Erlebnis. Die Roadrunner Veranstaltung, und da kommen eine Menge Leute, die in der Szene, in der Kunstszene, in der Museumsszene, in der Wirtschaftsszene wichtige Leute sind, die treffen sich hier zu diesen Veranstaltungen. Und ich nehme an, dort waren auch die Organisatoren und die Verantwortlichen vom CCC und haben dann festgestellt, wie viele andere auch, geile Location. Das Wort höre ich immer wieder. Sie sagen also, dass diese Einheit von Natur, Militärarchitektur, die Einheit von Geschichte, von musealer Arbeit, Kulturarbeit, diese Einheit ist wohl nicht so häufig.
Ja, das kann ich nur herausstreichen. Wir werden auch noch in den Shownotes zu dieser Sendung auf das Luftfahrtmuseum verlinken. Vielleicht können Sie uns noch sonst sagen, wenn Leute in der Gegend von Berlin, Eberswalde sind, haben Sie sowas wie reguläre Öffnungszeiten, falls Leute abseits dieses Events bei Ihnen vorbeischauen wollen?
Ach, Sie... Akustisch.
Haben Sie akustisch nicht verstanden?
Könnt ihr das hier nicht rauflegen?
Die ja, es ist im Grunde auch. Wahrscheinlich ist es nur nicht laut.
Ich verstehe die Fragen überhaupt nicht.
Ist es jetzt besser?
Nee.
Gar nichts. Ja, das werden wir nach der Sendung klären.
Hab das nur mit dem einen Ohr hier.
Okay. Nee, die Frage war, wie es denn, wann das Museum generell sonst noch geöffnet hat, wann man hier vorbeischauen kann.
Wir haben also täglich geöffnet in der Saison. Also wir haben keine Ruhetage von 10 bis 17 Uhr oder 18 Uhr. Aber wir sind ja eine private Initiative. Und da, wenn hier eine Gruppe um 17.30 Uhr oder um 18 Uhr kommt und zeigt ein deutliches Interesse, dann gibt es ja niemanden, der sagt, wir gehen mal wieder nach Hause. Nicht?
Okay, vielen Dank für dieses Interview. Ja, und auch nochmal herzlichen Dank dafür, dass Sie uns hier diese Gastfreundschaft zuteil werden lassen. Und ja, ich hoffe, wir sind noch wieder in 4 Jahren bei Ihnen zu Gast.
Ja, hoffe es auch. Freue mich schon jetzt. Danke.
Okay, gut. Und ich think we're gonna switch to... I think we'll switch to English now, but before we go on, I would like to play some music to maybe wait till the airplanes are gone. And yes.
What's happening in the room? We're searching.
Yes, and there we are back again. And now we'll continue in English, and we still have so much background noise. I can't tell you how crazy it is. Somehow I'm happy that this is the last show, because it's getting crazier and crazier, GMC. I mean, we've done such a professional show yesterday, and I told you before, I cannot top that. But still, I mean, we have great guests, and we'll continue now with a piece of net journalism, journalism about net politics, and therefore I'm happy to introduce Quentin, a net journalist from Belgium, and Jean-Marc, a net journalist from France, writing for Le Monde, at one of many newspapers or medias I think you write for. And maybe you give an introduction about yourself, because we didn't have so much time to get to know each other.
I'm journalist on the internet for the last 10 years. I mainly write about internet on the internet. I hardly work for the press, for the newspaper print, the printed newspapers. And I'm data journalism. I made data journalism at ovni.fr for 2 years now. And I'm also a blogger at Le Monde, because 3 years ago we had a huge scandal about police database in France. And following the scandal, Le Monde asked me to create a blog about surveillance society, the technologies and the politics of surveillance and privacy. Mm-hmm. And I'm also a member of the French Big Brother Awards.
Okay. Maybe we start with a term you mentioned, data journalism. What's your understanding of that? And can you give us maybe some examples of this
data
type of
journalism? It's a new kind of journalism that began with in the United States and in the Great Britain with the Guardian, notably. The idea is to visualize data, not to write stories, but to show data. And so we work with developers and with designers, and it's really interesting, because it's not only journalists who write stories, but it's a team of data journalists, web designers, and so developers. So it's a kind of journalist hacker or hack journalism. Mm-hmm. And there's in the United States, I think there are 1 or 2 universities that teach data journalism and hacking journalism. They teach hackers to become journalists and journalists to become hacker hackers and to deal with database.
Quentin, maybe you will follow and give us a brief introduction about you.
Yeah, so I'm a journalist on the internet since February. Because before that I only wrote for written newspapers. I'm working for a Protection of Human Rights Defenders NGO, and also as a freelance journalist, but only on society matters and not on net and politics. Basically, we are somehow, as Jean-Marc said, hacking a general newspaper in Belgium because they never speak about internet. They only give news, let's say attacks, anonymous attacks, and without going a little bit deeper into these topics. So somehow we're trying to just think a little bit more about what does hacking mean, who are hackers, and how do they interact with the political world. And when I say political world, I mean it in a broader sense, not only political parties, but sociological interactions within what I call the polis, so the city.
I mean, this type of journalism is definitely new, at least a combination of programming skills and data analysis with the publication function of a journalist is new in this form. And I wonder if you have also certain, if you notice certain differences in your work when you start trying to make sense out of data. You always have to interpret it, and you have to watch out for stories that are probably hidden somewhere in this database, in this bunch of gigabytes you have on your hard drive. And can you explain this process? Can you explain us?
I will tell you one example, one of the first example at OVNI, when WikiLeaks released his first cable. It was, I think, on a Sunday night. We arrived at the redaction on the morning. We didn't have any meeting. I began to dig on the database. The developers had already dumped the database locally, put it on a server, and began to try to figure how to propose a better way of digging in the database than WikiLeaks did, because WikiLeaks put a file on its server, on its website, but they have no wiki. Real wiki where people could dig into and annotate the data. There were no tags, there were no moteur de recherche, search engine. So the developers made the interface, the designer designed a new interface, a beautiful interface to dig into the database. I dig into the database to find informations about the French part of the database, and another journalist began to work with internauts to create a dictionary of the NATO words, because mm-hmm. NATO, it's not English NATO, it's really military spoken language, so we had to translate all the vocabulary in the database. And within 24 hours, we launched an interface to dig into WikiLeaks cables that was much easier than WikiLeaks proposed before, and with a system of annotation, of tagging, and we try to quote source the digging of the database mm-hmm. and invite people all over the world to help us find the cables which were the most interesting. So mm-hmm. that was one example of data journalism. Mm-hmm. And it's what is important, it's cooperation. It can sometimes I make something alone, but generally we must work with hackers, with developers, with designers, and with the people. It's not the journalist who speaks to people. It's mm-hmm. the journalist who speaks with people and who asks people questions and asks people to help him make this his inquiry.
And also, Le Monde, the newspaper you are writing for, is open in this matter. They accept this influence from their readers, from the general public.
It's more at OVNI. Le Monde begins to make data journalism, but the point is that to make data journalism, you have unless you have lots of money, like the New York Times, like the Guardian, and you can have big teams. To set up this kind of journalism, you must be agile. So it's a small crew. And because data journalism began three or four years ago in the United States and then Great Britain, and 2 years ago in France, Le Monde just began to deal with this. So it's more with OVNI that I data journalist.
I wonder, because of what you've just said, that you implemented a new interface which was so much better than the original one from WikiLeaks. I mean, Wiki is part of the name of this leaking platform, and the first approaches were that the public would dig into this data, would explain the leaks to itself and write analyses about it, but it never happened. This approach of Julian Assange never worked out. And so your organization as a newspaper started to do that. Was there ever any interest from the side of WikiLeaks into your system and into the way you did it?
After the release of our interface to dig into WikiLeaks, Julian Assange contacted us, and the second release of the cables, we were a part of the deal. So it was really interesting because OVNI is only 3 years old, and WikiLeaks made some partnership with Le Monde, El País, Der Spiegel, New York Times, Guardian, plus OVNI, with a small company. We were 25 at the moment. So WikiLeaks was interested in our way of digging with the database. And after, for the third release of the, we were not part of the deal, but we began to see that other media tend to create this kind of interface and data journalism base, because when you have so much information, you can't only ask journalists to write a story about one or two or 10 facts. No, you must deal with those tens of thousands or the dozens of thousands of data.
When you look at data journalism, I mean, it's probably a growing field. What would be needed to do it right in a news organization, no matter if it's a newspaper, a television station, or whatever?
You must work with developers and hackers. It's not only journalists. Newspapers and television, they work with photographs or people who know how to create images, beautiful images, and to edit those images. Well, on the internet, you've got to have hackers to work with you. You can't only write articles. You must create articles, create visualization. So you need hackers, and you need designers for this to be, and ergonoms, and for this to be nice to deal with.
You mentioned that you've been working 10 years now in this field. Have you noticed any real changes in the numbers of readers you had over these 10 years? I mean, is this a field of growing interest? Do you think it is recognized by the general public enough that net politics is part of general news?
Yeah, no, more and more. But, the thing is that 10 years ago, when I began, it was quite harsh because most of my colleagues on television, printed press, radio, tend to think that journalists on the internet will kill journalism because it was free. And now, so we are an enemy of the media and journalists. And now I've been asked to teach in school, in journalism school, because they realize that we are part of the solution and not part of the problem. So because politicians and news organizations realized that we're important, so the people realized also that we're important. And there's more and more people who are really scared for their privacy. So they read internet, because it's more on the internet that you know what's really going on about privacy, about surveillance technologies, than on television, on radio, and press.
Net politics often is a national matter in the European Union. And although sometimes you have central regulations like the data retention, usually there is no such thing as a broad knowledge about what the net politics situation is in France, is in Belgium. And especially in Germany, people tend to look more inside their own country than outside. So I would like to ask you both the question of what the current state of affairs is when it comes to net politics in your countries.
We start? Yeah. Well, in Belgium, the situation is quite pretty funny because we don't have any government since the last 400 days. So basically, it's difficult to pass law. Good laws and bad laws. So at the moment, there is something in the pipeline about, there is the ADOPI law in France, people from the right-wing parties want to implement such legislation in Belgium, and we have the Greens who are proposing something called the global license. Global license will be just that you pay a little bit more your provider in order to download things legally. The problem is that they are avoiding the debate about what is copyright, do we have good copyright laws, and to think a little bit more about this this notion of copyright, this concept, mm-hmm. because this concept is something like 500 years old, and at the moment, should we keep it or not? And there is another thing in the pipelines that we are just, our MPs are thinking about passing a law on net neutrality, such as one which has been passed in the Netherlands. So we have maybe bad things which are going to happen, and maybe a good thing to have a net neutrality. But at the beginning, they wanted to change the constitution and put something about net neutrality in it, but it's already been downsized to something much more like a small law, and then it's not as good as it could have been.
I don't know if any country has net neutrality in the constitution already. Maybe we go on with France before asking any more questions.
In France, I think they must have, we must count something like 40,000 journalists. On those 40,000 journalists, I think they must have several hundreds or several thousand who are specialized in sports, who are specialized in politics, who are specialized in economics. The journalists that are specialized, that are good on net politics, I think we must be several dozens. So it's really small. We've got two or three online newspapers that are really good on net politics, but they're only on the internet. And I don't know a journalist on television, two journalists on radio, two or three on radio, and several dozens on the internet that are good to define and to see what net politics is becoming. So we've got a lot of work to do, especially with our government, because you've probably seen that Nicolas Sarkozy, with his EG8 forum two or three months ago, wants to civilize the internet. And one, the French president says he wants to civilize the internet. That means we are some pirates, we're barbares, we're savage. So it's almost a declaration of war. And he lobbies, because it was the EG8, so he lobbies to have lots of other countries that adopt his ADP law. So it's quite a fight for the last years in French in France to defend net freedom.
Maybe you mentioned the ADP law. Maybe we should go into that. Can you explain what this is?
The ADP law, the idea is to scare people. So when there's a company, well, the ADP is an official organization that has been created last year. His budget is the same as the budget of the Data Protection Authority in France. The Data Protection Authority, which lasts for the last 30 years. In 30 years, they have they succeed in having, I think it's 15 million euros budget. The ADP law in 1 year has the same budget as the Data Protection Committee. The ADP pays a private company to monitor the internet, search to find those people who share some files. And when you are when you enter the database of this private company, you receive an email who warns you, stop downloading, stop sharing for those copyrighted files, because you'll have problems. If they don't stop, 400,000 people received this mail in 1 year. 20,000 received a printed letter. It's the second warning. The third warning, they pass in front of a judge, and they can be cut off from the internet. So at the moment, 10 persons have received this warning and will perhaps be thrown off the internet, and of those 10 people, one says, I'm innocent, I've never shared anything. That's because we know that this private company will make mistakes, because it's really simple to change an IP address, because all this surveillance of the internet is based on IP address, so it's bullshit.
Three Strikes Out is the name under probably which most German-speaking listeners will know this law and this proposal. And it's a very interesting case, because it raises the question not only of the IP address, if IP addresses are a good proof for any crime at all, it also raises the question of how do you detect illegal activities on the internet, what surveillance systems need to be installed to at least monitor what's going on the internet. And maybe we can go into technique here, as we are in Hacker Conference. Do you know any detail how they want to do this? Is it deep packet inspection, or do they just generally analyze the data on the backbones, or what do they do?
I don't know exactly how they proceed, because it's a secret, you know. I know they try to make the API, because there's a lot of people in France, but not only in France, that wants to develop the API. One point is important, is that 2 months ago, the server of this private company, whose name is TNJ, was opened on the internet. You can enter the HITS suspect database.
So it was hacked, or did they just had a
breach? It was a fail. It was not hacked. It was not someone who break in. It was open. They're done. So I don't know exactly how they proceed, but the idea is to monitor every netizen, and it will begin with copyright material, and with the LOPSI, another law in France, it is pedophilia, and who knows what's going on in the next years.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask you last question, which is, you're here now in this event in Germany, and I've noticed that there are quite a few journalists and also scientific researchers on this camp here. And what's your motivation to come here to Chaos Communication Camp? How do you perceive this event?
At the moment, right now, it's really amazing. But, well, it's something like, just imagine someone who likes watching sports and he goes to the Olympic Games, but he doesn't know really how to practice, I don't know, tennis or swimming. And then he sees those people just hanging around and developing good stuff and being creative, at some point even artistic, and just also sharing a lot of political ideas and just having workshop from 1 hour, but they in fact last for 2 hours, and that shows some kind of, well, huge and big dynamics. So for someone like me, which is not a hacker, who doesn't have a technical background, it's to see that it's quite really amazing at the moment, but I will need a few days just to go a step behind and think about it and begin writing about it, because at the moment we are meeting people, we do not all know them, and then we are just in more urgent journalism, and I think that we need 1 week just to begin to write about it and just cooling things down.
And from your journalistic perspective, how do you perceive it? Do you perceive it any different? Have you had interviews for your work here?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't change, because it's been 6 months that we are hanging in conferences, hackerspaces, in France, in Germany, in Belgium. And the people stay the same. It's not because they are at the Chaos Communication Camp that they change. So we need to build some kind of trust relationship with them. We are not going to go and just and them our microphone and say, well, no, answer the questions, please. We need just to talk about what's our project, to build this trust. And then afterwards, maybe we can just have a good interview. But that's one of the main specific points about here. If you go elsewhere, it's easier to get interviews. But sometimes people wouldn't care as much as the people we are talking here.
King Quentin, your final statement.
it's for the last 10 years I'm interested in hackers, in hackerspace and security and surveillance, etc. So that's normal for me to be there. And I'm here because I was invited. A lot of friends, French people who came here 4 years ago and who are here say, go, you must go to this place. So I went. What is strange for me is that in France, people know me because they've written my articles. Here, nobody knows me, except the French people. And I wear this pink card because I'm a journalist. And when you've got a journalist card somewhere, it's to go to backstage. You have some rights. With this pink card, I have less rights than other people in this place. So it's really strange for me. I understand that hackers fear journalists because there are so many journalists that wrote bullshit about hacking scene and hackers, etc. And it will last. But I know that we are more and more journalists that don't write bullshit about hacking. And I hope in 4 years, when I'll be back, I don't know if the card will be pink, but I hope it will be easier to get in touch with people, because I think it's more difficult. I was talking with a girl who make his thesis about women in the hack scene. And we know that there are not so many women in the hack scene. But I think it's easier for women to be here than for a journalist. So I hope it will be better, and the hackers and journalists will learn to talk to each other.
I think you just have to build up a reputation, then people will trust you. And funny enough, I wouldn't be here if it wouldn't be for a Frenchman. Jeremy from La Quadrature de Net is responsible that I'm here on this camp. And yeah.
He's responsible of lots of things.
Yeah, many good. I don't know of any bad. Okay, I honestly really thank you too for having you on the show. And I hope you come back, especially maybe in 4 years or in 2 years' time in the Netherlands, you can do your own show on our channel.
Yeah.
Creates a lot of trust. And yes, now we go on, because we only have 30 minutes left, with Noisebridge. And yeah, Ruben, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, there you are. And you brought some friends.
I've got three other Noisebridge members here. I have Michael, Andy, and Leaf. We are members of the San Francisco, or a hackerspace in San Francisco called Noisebridge, San Francisco, California. And we are here to talk about a project that we're starting.
Our project is called tor.noisebridge.net.
tor.noisebridge.net.
And as far as I understood it, it is a Tor exit node. Tor, for those people who don't know it, is an anonymization project, anonymization system, which is run globally and provides people access to the internet and anonymize their identity.
Let's go and Tor is kind of complicated, and it's kind of hard to grasp if you haven't dealt with anonymization on the internet before. There are people out there that would like to view the internet as it should be, without censorship, and would like to view the internet and go to places on the internet without actually being tracked. A good example would be a country going through a revolution, or possibly someone at a local library who wants to go look at content that involves breast cancer, but the net filters there won't let you Google breasts because you might get some sort of porno. What Tor does is Tor lets people start an entry node on their computer, and it creates a secure tunnel between their computer and another computer somewhere else on the internet. They have no idea where it is. That computer talks to another Tor node, talks to another Tor node, talks to another Tor node. No one really knows who's talking to what, except for that beginning tunnel kind of goes through. At some point in time, it exits out, it accesses the web page, gets the content, and brings it back to the end user. The website that they're accessing will really have no idea of where this person is coming from. They will only know where that exit node came from. And so this helps people try to break through firewalls that their countries have set up, and also anonymizes them slightly. It helps out the world.
It also prevents ISPs from messing with users' traffic.
Yes.
So there was recently a bunch of news in the U.S. about ISPs altering Google search results because they wanted to make some money by redirecting you to a different site. And Tor helps prevent that kind of analysis and redirection from happening.
And this change is legal in the States to...
After the news became public that they were doing this, they all stopped within less than a week. So probably not legal,
but
they were doing it until they got outed. We're doing?
Yeah. So what we're doing is Tor is great. Tor has a little bit of a problem in which Tor needs exit nodes. Tor needs nodes on the internet that are going to suck up some bandwidth and have a computer run 24/7 to help the project out, because you can jump into the Tor network, but if there aren't any exit nodes, it's your content or your traffic or what you're requesting isn't going to have any way to get back into the network to communicate with you. So Tor needs people to run exit nodes, and it's kind of costly. You have to run a machine. It's kind of a bit of a pain, and it's complicated. I've wanted to run one at my house for a while, and I haven't had the chance to actually sit down and figure out how to use the damn thing. So what we're starting is the tor.noisebridge.net service, which people can come through and basically donate money to us, and we will
go to Noisebridge,
and we will go ahead and use that money to set up a service for you. And the more people that donate, the more servers we can get at bulk. We can basically do more for Tor than people can do on an individual basis. And it takes the headache away from it. It's sort of like, you know, people pay for the cloud service or whatever. You know, you let Google deal with your email. Why not let someone else deal with the headache of helping the internet out and helping people out in countries and places and in situations where anonymization and the ability to view the internet without censorship is kind of necessary.
I think there are some legal implications also when you are running a Tor exit node, because the receiving site will get the IP address of the exit node, and I was wondering, how do you deal with that in your service?
The first thing to say about that is that running a Tor exit node is legal. It's specifically in the United States, which is where I've researched the issue. The laws governing network traffic have a specific set of rules for service providers. Service providers don't have an obligation to filter their users' traffic to make sure that it's legal. And running Tor is pretty clearly a network service that falls into this safe harbor. That said, cops and the FBI and the Secret Service are used to being able to track down their users, the bad people that they're trying to catch. Maybe they're bad, maybe they're being framed by someone, by tracking an IP address. And in the case of a person using Tor, that IP address is a Tor exit node. So the exit node operator will be the person who gets that phone call. In the case of the service that we're setting up, those exit nodes will be in data centers. So with NoiseBridge and the tor.noisebridge.net project as the point of contact for those, all we can really do, because of the structure of the Tor network, is to help inform the law enforcement about what Tor is and how it works, because it makes it impossible, as far as we can tell, for the operator to disclose anything about the user other than that there was a connection. Someone on the Tor network requested this content at this time. I don't have any logs of that. Tor doesn't log information by default, and I wouldn't want it to. And Ruben has something to say here.
Ruben.
Tor also doesn't save any content. So there's this whole thing about, I think the way that you would get in trouble for, let's say, downloading something on the internet that you're not supposed to download is that you have a copy of it and that you're able to rehost it. And Tor doesn't do that. Tor immediately grabs packets and sends them on their way and doesn't really care about what the packets are and doesn't save them or keep a record of them. For its own safety and for the safety of the users using it. which is great.
Yeah. I was wondering, because we also had a very famous tour exit note in Austria, which was run by the comedy chamber, a very respectable entity in Austria, which has lawful status and a very high reputation in conservative circles. And sadly, this tour note was closed down only recently, 3 months ago. But it helped a lot to argue with people if you have an institution like that, which could function as an exit note and which could also then deal with police requests or types of information agency requests about certain IP addresses. And so I was wondering if you think that Noisebridge is the right entity in this sense to be strong enough to stand against law enforcement agencies.
The law enforcement in the U.S., at least in my experience so far, and having asked many other Tor node operators what their experiences have been, there aren't any examples of Tor operators being brought to court. There are examples of Tor operators overly enthusiastically running nodes on machines they didn't control, didn't have permission to use. That obviously is just a question of that operator making a mistake and misusing services that he didn't have permission to use in that way. There are also examples of over-enthusiastic law enforcement raids tracking an IP address to a home IP address and raiding that home to confiscate the data. And those have always ended up not going anywhere because Tor doesn't do the things that the law enforcement who's doing that raid thinks that it's doing. So education is the answer for that.
Yeah. And I think the system has to stay alive and has to become even more vital, and the project you're doing here definitely is a good step on that path, because you're specializing on running Tor exit nodes. And so
that's right.
If you can be seen somehow as a charity, for example, I mean, people give you money and then you could do good for it. You know?
In fact, we are. We're a 501c3 charitable organization in the United States, which has some potential tax advantages for donors, although you should always consult with your tax professional whenever making tax decisions.
This looks like a disclaimer you totally are legally bound to say.
It's a pretty standard disclaimer, yeah. And it looks like Leaf has a few things to add here.
Yeah,
the 501c3 status was definitely part of why we're doing this through Noisebridge. This is a very new project for the Noisebridge organization, but it's not new for its members. Several Noisebridge members have run exit nodes already, and some currently run exit nodes now. But now, as of tomorrow, Noisebridge will be beginning to accept donations to do this. So if you'd like to contribute to what will probably be, I believe, one of the largest, larger, or if not the largest exit node in the United States, you can donate as of tomorrow at tor.noisebridge.net.
Okay. Do you have any plans to make this a general hackerspaces project? I mean, maybe let the people know about your experiences at the next Congress or...
Absolutely. We're committed to making our configurations and scripts and all of the information that we learn in this process publicly known. So we've already got some Git repositories with scripts and verbiage in them, and we plan to continue that, and we'll be talking about it at Congress.
And there's nothing stopping us from eventually expanding into doing combining up with other hackerspaces and doing this too. I mean, if another hackerspace wants to collect donations and just send them our way, we'll be happy to do a lot of that work. Mm-hmm. But I mean, half the fun in this for us is to actually set these machines up and get it going.
Yeah.